The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today, of course, we're going to have John Williams on, and he's probably the best statistician. I know that doesn't sound exciting, but the best statistician with government numbers that probably is out there that's not bought off by the government. But before we go to that, we've got Bert Doman on the line.
Yeah, Kevin, I think the importance of the conversation with both of these gentlemen today, and one is really a preview of coming attractions, but our conversation today with John Williams will look at inflation, not only the inflation that he sees nascent in the system, but hyperinflation, and his timescale has been rolled back. It's not 2018, 2014, a four-year window. He would suggest that it's 2014 at the outside, likely imminent. So there's some issues there. He's releasing a report this week, which I think every listener should get their hands on. But as a preview of coming attractions, we've got these various triggers which may cause significant problems, not only in our financial system, but ultimately be that which ignites the hyperinflation.
Yeah, you have to look outside of the United States possibly for a trigger that's going to cause something within our own borders.
Well, and that's why we are going to be talking to Bert Doman. He's done a special report on China and the frailties within the Chinese economy. And that's going to be aired in a couple weeks. But just as a preview of coming attractions, we want to have a conversation with him because we've got a new GDP statistic out this week. Fourth quarter 2011 GDP was running at an 8.9% number, and there's been a variety of responses to that number as it's been released.
Well, David, that sounds like an excellent seminar with Bert Doman coming up. I'm sorry that you couldn't make it, but you're going to actually be in New York at the time. You can't be two places at once. Now I'd like to go, if we could, to John Williams. You know, this is a man who the government loves to hate, actually, because of the statistics. He just takes their numbers, and he brings about the real conclusions instead of the altered conclusions, and really is reporting like an economist probably would have, or a government statistician would have reported 20 or 30 years ago.
Kevin, you find that economics is very similar to philosophy in the sense that the work that you're doing is based on certain assumptions, and if you're not regularly checking those assumptions, the work that you're doing may in fact be flawed. And that's what we find him doing as an economist. I love it, Kevin. He has the focus of a bird dog, and it's beautiful to watch. Frankly, I'm glad I'm not the bird dog in this instance, because there are so many statistics and so many assumptions that go into government statistics.
A lot of detail.
I'm glad he's the man for the job, and that's why we want to entertain the conversation today. What are the numbers telling us about hyperinflation and our current economic malaise? Bert, we're looking forward to spending an hour or so with you in coming weeks to talk about issues relating to both China and Europe and really the world economic picture. I know between now and the time we get to spend that conversation on the air, January 21st, 2012, you're going to be at the Intercontinental Hotel and you're doing a closed-door seminar for only 100 people. And I wanted to bring this to our listeners' attention because it's a rare opportunity to have both fundamental and technical insight from someone with your experience, 35 years of writing and research in the investment field.
Yeah, David, thank you very much for the introduction and for mentioning the seminar. It's in Century City, Los Angeles, California. So, and people are flying in for this three-hour seminar, so we're very happy about that. It's the first one I've done in about 10 years, and the reason I'm doing it is because I think the timing is absolutely critical. It's very much like 2007. Never wanted to write a book because it's very tedious work, but in 2007 I said we're going to have an event like 1929 next year, and people have to be forewarned, and I wrote a book called Prelude to Meltdown. So I think right now this seminar is very similar in urgency, and that's why it's important. I think, you know, the focus, of course, has been on Europe all this time and the crisis over there, and that is far from being resolved. But they will be able to kick the can down the road. Greece will probably exit in some way or another, maybe just suspend their membership and so on. But the real problem, in my opinion, will come out of China. China's problems are way underestimated. We got a report today, for example, on China GDP. We came in at 8.9% for last year. 8.7 had been expected. So this is now bringing out all the China bulls. Fantastic GDP growth. But if you look at the real numbers, the last quarter was the worst GDP growth China has had since the depths of the financial crisis in the second quarter of 2009. It's the worst. Okay. If you take a look at real estate prices, they're down 50% in many of the big cities. Sales are down 60 and 70% of real estate. They're pretending everything is well and China is going to be the locomotive of the world. China is going to be the neutron bomb of the world economies. When the demand from Europe dries up to go into, China is going to be in desperate trouble. The exports will just really shrink. And the Chinese companies are already in deep financial trouble. They're not making money. They cannot get any loans from the banking system anymore to finance their continuing operations. That is the real big problem ahead.
Well, this is a great time to be talking about this because following the Chinese New Year, we'll probably have an indication of what kinds of policy measures will be put in place by the Politburo, either in support of the economy or if they're attempting to sort of navigate a soft landing, so to say. But as you said, Bert, 8.9% on GDP, you end up overstating GDP if you're understating inflation. On the ground, inflation is assumed to be between 10 and 15%, and that would actually put their GDP in a very low level, not even 8.9%, maybe even 1 or 2%, depending on how high their actual rate of inflation is, perhaps even negative.
Absolutely, David. You're so right. The inflation adjustment is totally phony for the GDP numbers in China, as it is in the United States. But if you look at the real numbers, you know, like the growth rate of electrical consumption, this is a free market rate in China, okay? That shows you that China right now is already in a contraction. If you look at manufacturing numbers out of China, China is already in a contraction. GDP numbers include governmental spending. The government is pouring so much money into fixed investments. This is a huge part of economic growth over there. So the deeper the recession goes in China, I guess the more apartments the government will build, which will remain empty. And that is the problem. You have to see, what is the GDP number made of? Is it the private sector? No, the private sector part of the economy is at 33%. It's shrinking. It's going down. Because the companies are letting their people go, companies are going out of business, and China is going into a recession.
Well, Bert, we're on the edge of some really interesting things. 2012, 2013, 2014 served to be very interesting, very promising if you're on the right side of the trends. We want to explore China with you in depth next week, but also wanted to take the opportunity just to underscore Century City, the Intercontinental Hotel, January 21st, your three-hour seminar. And for anyone who's interested in attending, the cost details, etc., $195 per person, and you can contact Bert's office at 310-476-6933. I'll repeat that. Area code 310-476-6933. Obviously, Bert, we've got a lot more to talk about, and we look forward to that conversation here in the next few weeks.
David, it's always a pleasure to speak with you because you're one of the most knowledgeable people in the business.
Well, thank you. We look forward to seeing you, and I'm sorry we couldn't be there for the Century City presentation. We would have loved to have been, but we'll make it on the next one.
All right. Very good, David. All the best to you and to your listeners.
Okay, take care. John, it's great to have you with us. As we begin 2012, we look at a number of factors which are fairly critical. When we look at economic reporting and the data that's coming out of our different government agencies, you have a few things that stand out here at the beginning of the year. $15.3 trillion is roughly our gross domestic product. It's also our national debt. Now, that's not the sum total of our liabilities, but we are now at 100% of GDP. And that is one thing we want to look at today, kind of some of the big picture issues in terms of our economy and what some of these economic statistics imply as we look at 2012, 2013, 2014. We're above 90% on the debt to GDP level. That has always implied a lower growth environment moving forward, carrying that much debt. That's not the only issue. We've got a lot of things to cover with you today. We want to talk about the deficit, of course. We want to talk about the real deficit, gap-based federal deficit. We want to talk about employment statistics, where we're at and where you see us going. Some comments on bank lending and whether or not that will improve or if we're just going to be stuck in the mud in terms of velocity. And then maybe just a little bit on the depth and duration of the contraction we have been in, contrary to some perhaps at the NBER who would say we're clearly out of the recession. And you know, we're going to cover some of these big picture points and have you shed some light for us on the importance of statistics and what they tell us today as signs and signals of what lies ahead.
Well, that's quite a bit, and I'm happy to help wherever I can. where do you want to start?
Let's start in with the federal deficit. 2010 was $1.299 trillion, and then 2011 was virtually the same, $1.294 trillion. And you've pointed out that the gap-based federal deficit is quite a bit higher than that. What's the difference between the headline number that we see advertised, that $1.2, $1.3 trillion number, and the gap-based deficit?
Well, the gap-based deficit is based on generally accepted accounting principles, where the government's operations are reported as a large corporation might report its operations. This has been in place now for pretty much well beyond a decade now, where the Treasury has been publishing these reports. Came out of the efforts back in the 1970s of what were then the Big Ten accounting firms in Congress to bring the federal government's operations under better control and so people could understand what was happening. Despite all the efforts, the Government Accountability Office, still called the GAO, which does the auditing, won't sign off on the statements because of problems with auditing of the Defense Department and Homeland Security. But as it puts all the numbers together, there's an area which is not widely followed, but it's extremely important in terms of whether or not the nation is solvent. And unfortunately, the nation is not, at least not on a long-term basis. The issue is in terms of the unfunded liabilities for Social Security, Medicare, and such. And the way they handle it in the financial statements is they show the numbers as estimated by the various trust funds, but they reflect it in terms of net present value, so that we have a shortfall of, let's say, $20 trillion net present value. That's how much cash you'd have to have in hand today, earning money on that going forward to cover that liability. So that in terms of the year-to-year change, which would be effectively go to the income statement, or would be the net deficit or surplus, depending upon which way it went, instead of being in the area of that the government reports with a cash deficit around the 1.3 trillion range, which is extraordinary in and of itself. We're seeing annual deficits right now of $5 trillion. That's with all the annual change reflected there on an accounting basis for the deterioration in the Social Security and Medicare.
I mean, if it was 1.3, you'd say that's really not a sustainable trajectory.
Well, 1.3 certainly is not. $5 trillion is beyond any hope. To put that into perspective, if you wanted to, let's say, bring the system into balance for 1 year, let alone make it solvent going forward, you could not raise taxes enough to eliminate the deficit. You could take 100% of everyone's salary and wages. You'd still be in deficit. On the spending side, you could cut every penny of government spending, except for Social Security and Medicare. You'd still be in deficit. I get a lot of comments, why are you targeting Social Security? I fully appreciate the feelings there. I paid into Social Security, too. The problem is the system has been expanded by the politicians beyond anything that's sustainable. They cannot conceivably raise enough taxes or balance with the existing political limits on spending. The deficit going forward, we're insolvent. We'll get to a point that the government cannot fund its operations or borrow enough to fund its operations. We actually saw that in this last year. Very unusual time where the Federal Reserve, with its quantitative easing 2 package, actually bought in net Treasury securities more than the Treasury issued for public consumption. So the Fed effectively, in that period of time, fully monetized the federal debt. That will be in, it is working through the system, very, very inflationary, and we have, unfortunately, a lot more of that ahead. But if the government can't have normal auctions, if it cannot raise the funds from people who want to lend the money to the government, domestic or foreign, it will most likely do what almost every other country in that type of circumstance has done, and that is they will print the money they need to make their obligations. And that becomes very inflationary, hyperinflationary.
And that brings us to the point of a report that you put together a year ago or thereabouts, Hyperinflation Special Report 2011. You've updated that with a few data points and are doing a new release here in the next few days. I'll be quite frank, if anyone who listens to our weekly commentary has not read the special report because you don't subscribe to shadow government statistics, you're a little out in the cold without a jacket. This is called necessary reading. The idea within the 66-page report, which is about to be re-released with all the updates, is essentially that we are moving towards hyperinflation. And you, I think, argue very effectively that this process has begun over the last 10 years, became a virtual certainty by 2004, has been accelerated as a result of the financial crisis and Washington, D.C.'s tinkering with the system, unfortunately not very effectively. And maybe you can speak to the acceleration of the process and some of the dots that you're connecting that would imply the inevitable circumstance of hyperinflation here in the U.S.
Sure. Before we had the financial crisis broke in 2007, 2008, the system was headed for hyperinflation by the end of the current decade, say by 2020. That was just the way the government's obligations were lined up. We were seeing deficits still averaging $5 trillion a year on a GAAP accounting basis, completely unsustainable. By 2020, you would have been at a point where the government would have had to print the money to meet its obligations. There's no way it could sustain that with borrowing. We had a circumstance develop in 2006, 2007, where the economy started to turn down sharply, particularly in the housing area, which helped to trigger a financial crisis. The economy helped to trigger the financial crisis. The financial crisis exacerbated the downturn in the economy. And we saw almost a collapse in economic activity going through the year 2007 into 2008, even to 2009, and have been pretty much bottom bouncing since, irrespective of the official pronouncements out of Washington. But in August, September of 2008, the people in Washington realized that they had so loused up the system that they were on the brink of a systemic failure, that the banking system was going to collapse if they didn't do something. They weren't kidding about that. We shouldn't have gotten to that point, but having got to that point, they had to do what they had to do and put forth all sorts of emergency spending, lending, guarantees. They created whatever money they had to in order to keep the system from failing. And I'll contend that they will continue to do that so long as the markets will let them get away with it. The problem is that the cures that they put forth did nothing to resolve the problem. It bought them a little time in terms of systemic stability, but the systemic solvency crisis continues. The banks are not healthy. The big banks are still in trouble. We have another crisis that's brewing here. The U.S. economy did not recover. It, in fact, is still bottom bouncing, and it is about to turn down again. All these factors will keep the Fed and the Treasury, the federal government, trying to pump money into the economy, doing some form of stimulus, providing liquidity to the banking system. The cost of all that are very inflationary, and that has accelerated the process whereby, and if you look over the last year, the actions taken by the Fed, by the federal government, did a lot to kill global confidence in the U.S. dollar. And then you go to the events back in July, August of last year, where they had the negotiation over the debt ceiling and the inability to come up with a deficit reduction package, any willingness to actually take the political steps necessary to slash the social spending, which is effectively speaking the looming national bankruptcy. And as that fell apart, the rest of the world was watching the United States, and if you looked at the market reaction, this was even before the downgrade to the U.S. Treasuries, you had panic selling of the dollar. The Swiss franc was soaring, gold was soaring, and that's one of the prerequisites to having the hyperinflation here. It's a loss of confidence. Loss of confidence in the dollar. Then there were all sorts of market interventions. I'll contend that the crisis in Europe is a real problem, but there was a lot of effort made to focus market attention on the crisis in Europe as sort of a foil to get people away from concentrating. The efforts were made to curtail the rise in gold prices. The Swiss National Bank moved to, at least for a short period of time, to tie the Swiss franc to the euro to effectively prop the euro and to effectively prop the dollar. It's an unstable, very volatile situation that could break apart at any time. And as it does, I mean, there are a number of things that could push it over the edge, such as renewed Fed action, which is a virtual certainty, just a matter of when it hits, that you'll start to see this circumstance move very rapidly to a higher inflation, and then as the confidence in the dollar continues to shrink into a hyperinflation. You know, a lot of people say, oh my goodness, how can you have inflation with a weak economy? And indeed, we have a weak economy, and it's a lot of problem with what's being reported, but you look at something as simple as payroll employment. Despite all the problems with the reporting of the series, and I'm happy to talk about the problems of the reporting of the series, it's probably the best quality broad economic statistic that the government publishes. Just don't pay too much attention to the month-to-month changes. Much better than the GDP, and it's a coincident indicator of economic activity. If you look at what's happened there, it's plunged into late 2000 and 2008, 2009 period, and pretty much has been bottom bouncing. It's moved a little bit higher, but it's far from having recovered the level that it was before the recession started. The official recession started in 2007. I'm talking about the level of payroll employment, number of jobs that people are being paid for on company payrolls.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com.
So when we look at the employment statistics as they're issued, the U3 and U6 numbers, and of course you do a reconfigured number there, which also factors in discouraged workers, short-term and long-term discouraged workers, what's our real picture? Are we closer to sort of a 1973, 1974 era of unemployment?
Yes. I mean, if you go back to the way the numbers used to be estimated, and it's impossible to fully reconstruct it, I think we're up around 22% unemployment, and there have been problems going back over time. You'd find that that's probably about as bad as we've had since the Great Depression, which would take you back into the mid-70s recession. There's a very important point on the payrolls that I'd just like to get in there.
Oh, yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
That is that the current level of payroll employment, most recent reporting, is well below where it was in December 2007 in this recession. It's also well below where it was at the beginning of the recession in 2001. That's 10 years ago. The payrolls today are below where they were a decade ago, and that's despite a 10% growth in the population. There's no way you can look at that and think of being in a normal economic circumstance. It's not there. It's an absolute catastrophe. You get all sorts of games playing and hyping by Wall Street and the politicians, but we're going through a major structural change. It's got a long ways to play out, and looking at the issues that we were discussing very briefly in terms of the deficit and the spending, all the forecasts going forward on the federal budget deficit, for example, are based on assumptions of underlying economic growth. We're not going to have that. So the deficit's going to be a lot worse. The funding needs of the Treasury are going to be a lot worse again. All this combines together in really a perfect storm for the financial markets.
What you've just said is precisely what we see in real time in Greece. You know, it was just a few months ago that they had resolved the Greek debt issue, and you had a 50% haircut, which was done on a, quote, voluntary basis. And now they're finding that growth in the economy, that was one of the assumptions that you just said we have as well, was not as robust as needed, as expected, as factored in. And 50% is not going to be enough of a haircut. Maybe 60. I've even heard numbers as high as 75%. And this is the issue. They did buy themselves 3 to 4 months through the job owning and through the exercise, but ultimately nothing on a structural basis was changed. They didn't increase their revenues, they didn't decrease their expenses, and they still have a massive amount of debt as overhang. And that really does sound a lot like us. Although we're not Greece, our numbers and the circumstance we're in are similar.
Yes.
Too much debt overhang, revenue deficiency, and spending that's out of control.
Well, the big difference is Greece can no longer print drachmas. We can still print and do print dollars. Within the European Union, there are ways in which you can behave, and you can't just issue willy-nilly a domestic currency when you no longer have a domestic currency. You get into the issue of the way the credit rating agencies look at this. Normally, a credit rating agency would not give anything less than a AAA rating to a sovereign debt issued in the currency of the sovereign. And the rationale behind that is that the sovereign always has the ability to print the money to pay the debt. And the credit ratings are based on risk of default. On that basis, in theory, there should have been no downgrade to the U.S. Treasuries. The reason you had the downgrade wasn't because we've put ourselves in a position of long-term insolvency for the U.S. government, and indeed we have done that. It was that with the debt ceiling in place and the threats of default and the fighting over that, and that the risk of default was no longer viewed as zero. where the country could just print the money, that you could actually have a formal default. So that's why you had the downgrade in the U.S. dollar. But the U.S. dollar is still one where we have been and always can, at least as things are currently structured, print whatever money we need to meet our obligations. Greece does not have that opportunity. The situation in Europe is an unhappy one. I don't think the euro ever should have been put together. I mean, the people who thought that Germany and could align its fiscal policies with Greece and Italy and France just didn't know the countries involved. I mean, there's a strong desire from among some to get a unified currency, but you're seeing that circumstance fall apart at this point in time. In many ways, the euro, if you broke the euro into its constituent currencies, you'd probably find the euro recombined would be a lot stronger than it is now. The markets are overly discounting the cost of Greece on the European system. But that will resolve itself. And I'm not a specialist on the euro circumstance, but I can tell you with virtual certainty that if there's any event there that currently is foreseeable, and there certainly has been enough time to work through out all the different scenarios that may come from this, the Fed has been looking very carefully at what could bring about a domino effect in the system that could bring down the U.S. banking system. The Fed will do whatever it has to do to prevent the collapse of the banking system. If it has to bail out Italy, it'll bail out Italy. Mr. Bernanke has the ability to do that. The U.S. Treasury doesn't. And the U.S. Treasury right now is probably under some political constraints, but if you end up with the type of circumstance that you followed, that you had following the Lehman collapse back in 08, I think even there you'd find Congress moving to prevent a systemic collapse. That's a failure of the system, a failure of the banking system, and it's an absolute failure for the Fed. It's not a circumstance anyone in Washington wants to see, but there's nothing they can do to fundamentally fix it. All they can do is kick the proverbial can down the road. And I think we're going to have one more attempt here at kicking the can, but in doing so, we're also going to be collapsing the dollar, and that's going to accelerate the process towards the hyperinflation.
You've picked a time frame of 2014 to 2018 and have begun to shrink that a bit more towards the 2014 horizon.
I put 2014 as an outside timing on this.
As an outside timing.
I'll contend that we're actually through some of the early stages of it, although you're not seeing the inflation, we've passed some of the benchmarks, things that you have to happen for this to play out, and that's very specifically is the global loss of confidence in the U.S. dollar.
Let me focus on two things here, because first of all, and this is just repeating what I said earlier, if listeners aren't willing to invest a few dollars in the report in your subscription service, two things you need to do. One is order Adam Ferguson's book, The Death of Money, or When Money Dies. Because it's When Money Dies, you see the historical side of a hyperinflation, and it's not so much the economic, but the social, political, and cultural changes that one experiences in that context, and I think that's worth knowing what it looks and feels like. Now, how you get there in terms of the economics, that's where you need to fast forward and say, okay, well, looking at this from the 2004 to 2014 or 2020 inevitability, which you just described, and now all of a sudden those puzzle pieces being in place for it to be a present tense reality. Again, if you're not going to go to shadowstats.com, spend $89 for a 6-month subscription, $175 for a 1-year subscription, have this report and all of the other resources that come from Shadow Stats, what you're doing is limiting your ability to thrive and survive in what is an absolute catastrophe. Please do not trivialize the interview with John Williams today, because this is a look ahead at something that we would agree with John is a virtual certainty. The question is timing. We don't know when, but we certainly see this moving. And there is this acceleration that's taking place. You know, crisis seems to be, as one of our guests from Europe has said, crisis compresses time. And the things which have taken 10 years to occur are now happening within months and in quarters, and will ultimately take place in weeks and days. That's the nature of hyperinflation. As confidence is lost, and as there is a crisis, it's a psychological crisis, which the telltales are in the currency, and you can see what's happening by the devaluation of the currency, but it's actually a psychological snap.
I can't argue with anything you said there.
So, John, in light of this, we look at two things. First of all, we know that you can still go to Shadow Stats and read the past copy, if you will, the special commentary number 357, your hyperinflation special report for 2011. Please take the time to read the 2012 version as well. But the general public can go and read the 2011 version now. Maybe you can bring this into perspective. Sometimes we look at Germany as an instance of hyperinflation, but what about Zimbabwe? That's a little bit more present tense.
Well, they're lessened from both, but one of the remarkable things about Zimbabwe, I mean, it's probably the worst hyperinflation any nation's ever experienced. If you take the $2 bill from the original currency, and then you go through all the iterations and whopping of zeros that they had from the notes, having got of time, $100 trillion notes. I don't think they went to a quadrillion because no one knew what a quadrillion was. But if you were to come up with a $2 bill in the last version of the currency and make a pile of those that equaled the original $2 bill, that pile would have stretched from the Earth to the Andromeda Galaxy, literally light years high, there's not enough trees on Earth to print it. Just absolute devastation in terms of the currency's value. The hyperinflation, however, took place and accelerated over a period of a couple of years. At that same time, the economy still functioned, although there were problems, but people worked. What they do, though, the way they survived, the way the economy continued to function, was that they had a black market in U.S. dollars. So if you were paid your Zimbabwe dollars, you could immediately go convert them into U.S. dollars. You then had a store of wealth, and you could operate off that. The problem in the United States is we're dealing with the world's reserve currency, largest economy. We have no such black market in the United States. You don't have a backup to the dollar, at least at this point in time. And without that, you see a much more rapid and devastating impact on the economy. You'll see disruption in supplies to grocery stores and food deliveries. And you get the food off the shelves in a grocery store. That's about as fast a way as I can think of to start triggering civil disorder. It becomes a very dangerous situation. Now, what I'm about to cover is not at all political. I mean, the gentleman involved, Dr. Ron Paul, is indeed running for the presidency on the Republican side of the primaries now. But he introduced legislation in Congress, at least a man of thinking, that would make gold legal tender. It could be treated as a currency so that you could trade. I mean, you could take Federal Reserve notes and exchange them for gold at the ongoing exchange rate without any tax consequence. If something like that actually were put into place, you would then have a functional backup for the dollar, for the Federal Reserve notes, which are what are going to go through this hyperinflation. And that in many ways would mitigate some of the immediate devastation that you'd see in the economy. So it'd actually be a plus for the economy. Something like that could be put into place, but I don't see that happening. I just mention it because it is. This is something that has arisen in the last year and is new since I last updated the hyperinflation report.
It would certainly represent a challenge to the monopoly status of Federal Reserve notes. And from all of your dear-hearted, wonderful Federal Reserve bankers, I don't know that they would be super enthusiastic about that competition.
That's putting it mildly.
Well, John, like books, there's ideas that need to be tasted, others chewed, and others yet digested. And here we are looking at inflation and the consequences socially, politically, real decisions that have to be made in light of the things that are in the pipeline already. And these are things that we really need to ruminate on. Join us next week as we continue the conversation on these same issues and explore them further with you.
Well, David, you know, what a fascinating interview so far. I can't wait to hear what's going to be said next week. But I think the thing that we have to focus on here is he is saying hyperinflation is a fait accompli. It is something that will occur, that the government's already pre-programmed into this economy. I think the thing that numbs us to hyperinflation is just how quickly it can hit. You can go from a state of almost zero inflation to a state of hyperinflation, such as Germany and then ultimately Zimbabwe.
Kevin, I think there's a remarkable similarity with hyperinflation, that event, that snap event that occurs, and what we see in the debt markets. Because oftentimes what you'll see is perfect stability and ideal pricing, interest rates at all-time lows, signifying that there's no risk in the system, just before you have a snap in interest rates, and all of a sudden you can go from a 2 to a 10 in terms of an interest rate. That's what we've seen in the debt panics all throughout Latin America, and there is that interesting component where something changes, and, yeah, and it really is more of a psychological event than one that's even monetary.
Well, I'll tell you, what it reminds me of, David, and this is a tragedy that's occurring in Italy right now, but if you've ever been on a cruise ship, you are in another world. I mean, you don't really feel like you're on a boat at all. You can barely feel the rocking. You've got all the food that you need. You've got your room. You've got lights. You've got entertainment. And what happened in Italy is that just suddenly changed.
So, in fact, you thought that somebody was making good decisions for you, when in fact the captain of the ship prioritized his own survival over even the obligations that he had as quote-unquote captain.
He made bad decisions, and then he abandoned ship. Now, I'm not saying that Ben Bernanke's going to abandon ship, but he sure is making bad decisions.
No, but it does point us to one thing, Kevin, in the context of hyperinflation. And John, this is where we'd like to take the conversation next week. It's in the direction of an individual understanding their responsibility and the choices that they have to make in order to do well, survive, thrive in a period of time of incredible stress and chaos brought about by economic and financial mismanagement.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.